This is episode 416, dated Friday, June 13th, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to In Perspective. I am Bob Branco. Great to be here today. This is episode 416, dated Friday, June 13th, 2025. First of all, let me introduce my good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how are you?
Hello, Bob and audience. We're doing fine. The weather in Coos Bay is taking a turn for the frigid. It's like 58 degrees with a 20-25 mile an hour wind coming off the ocean. So it's raw and cold and windy, and it's unusual to be this cold, but no rain. So we're happy.
We are in the 70s. It was humid yesterday. It was close to 85. In fact, I think it got up to 88 yesterday. Very hot. Today's in the 70s. Summer is right around the corner, and you can tell here in southern New England. Let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer, our media outlets, and of course, Jacqueline Sylvia of JS Web Solutions, who archives our shows on my website. In order for you to find them, just go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will see most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to Beth Roth, a faithful listener to In Perspective. Thank you very much for your letters. We appreciate them, and we encourage others to do the same. And at this time, let me introduce Trish, our facilitator, and of course, Brad, our streamer. And because we are being streamed live, I will give out my email address for others who would like to write letters to talk about our program. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. bobbranco93@gmail.com. Today we're very pleased to have with us another author. His name is Kevin Hupschman. He wrote a book called One More Reason to Cry. Very interesting title. Kevin, thanks for appearing with us today. We appreciate it.
Good evening. Happy Friday the 13th.
So give us an idea of what your book's about. Tell us what led you to write it.
Well, I have been loosely journalizing my life for over 40 years now, and I held off publishing this book because I wanted to focus on my wife Trish's writing career, and she's turned out numerous detective fiction books known as the Tracy Gale Mysteries. Finally, I saw an opportunity to have this book published last year, and I thought the experience would be cathartic for me, as I have diagnosed PTSD and a lot of internal demons. But even though I'm happy to have turned out a book that's true to myself, I think my traumas in life will forever live with me.
So let's talk a little bit about who you are apart from an author. You said you were a journalist. Talk about, you know, your experience doing that kind of work.
Well, no, I just mentioned that I was journalizing.
Oh, journal. Life. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. So talk about your sort of background, apart from writing.
Well, I went to school, went to Adelphi University in New York. My major at the time was English. I received a degree in English with a minor in education. My goal was to be a secondary school English teacher, but at that time there were few jobs available and it didn't work out well for me. Then I turned to another interest of mine, which was trying to break into a career in publishing or copywriting, editing, because I really like that kind of stuff. I see when I watch the news, I see mistakes being misspelled and all the time. And I really pick up on that kind of stuff. And so I spent another year out of college, going into Manhattan every day and pounding the pavement, trying to get my foot in the door, but that also didn't pan out. So I ended up working for New York State Civil Service. I started taking civil service tests for various jobs, and I ultimately was working for the tax department in Brooklyn, New York, and I had higher aspirations. I was a tax collector, and I went back to school to get the necessary accounting credits needed to further my career. Started taking tests for auditor position, and I moved over to the Department of Labor as a senior payroll investigator. I did unemployment insurance, payroll tax audits, basically for 32 years. I retired about, this December. I'll have been retired for 9 years. I retired at 55 with 32 years of service.
And you mentioned, and I don't want to talk about things you're uncomfortable with, but you mentioned some of your demons and your PTSD. Talk about that a little bit, as much as you feel comfortable. How did that happen? And whatever you want to talk about regarding that part of your life.
Well, it's mainly because, as you know, we see in the book, the character Ken Halsey is not living his best life. He's plagued with insecurities, bullying, non-supportive parents, poor choices of friends. So there's things that I went through all through my life. Growing up in Brooklyn was a little easier because I had a lot of friends there, and it was just a very tight-knit community. And then my father moved us out to Long Island because he was afraid things were getting bad in Brooklyn. I really did not want to move. And pretty much from day one that we moved to Seaford, Long Island, I was made fun of, teased, bullied. I don't know. I just, there's plenty of examples of it in the book, and it just seemed to continue through grade school, through junior high, through high school, even through college. So I kind of started feeling like you never get away from it. Like everything, my saying is everything is high school. And that's kind of the way it's been for me.
I have a question about your book, but before I do, I want to make a comment. I have relatives who live in the Bay Shore, Long Island area. Are you familiar with Bay Shore?
Yes, as a field payroll tax auditor, I covered almost all of Nassau County, Suffolk County. I've been out to the Hamptons. I've had to take ferries out to Fire Island. I've even worked in Queens, parts of Queens, when they were short-staffed and they needed people to go there. So I am very familiar with all parts of Long Island.
My, do we hear the term short-staffed very often today. It's incredible. That's all we hear, short-staffed, short-staffed, short-staffed. Yeah. As far as your book is concerned, Kevin, do you regard it, in a sense, as an autobiography?
I do. I would say it's, you know, the majority of it is mostly fictionalized reality of my life with, like, a little deviation, except for some possible distortions and embellishments of factual events.
What prompted you to write it in that style as compared to, say, a memoir or, as Bob said, an autobiography?
Well, I come up with a lot of good ideas for my wife, Trish, for her fiction books. And I'm a big fan of fiction, not particularly nonfiction. So while I can come up with a lot of ideas for books, I can't really flesh them out. So she's used a lot of my ideas in her books. But I wanted to write a fictional book, and the details and facts of my life were already fleshed out, so it wasn't as difficult to come up with a fictionalized book.
And what prompted you to be a writer? I mean, you know, it's not an easy job to write a book. What got you interested in writing?
Well, I always say that in talking to people, a lot of people, you know, they have interesting lives, more interesting than they might think. And I always say that every person has a book in them, but it's the very slim majority that will take their experiences, bad and good, and put them into a book. And usually when they do, it is nonfiction, but with nonfiction, you know, people don't know who I am. So unless you're a person of note, I think you'd be better off writing a fictionalized version because it would attract more people.
So one of the things that interested me about the book and your life, you mentioned this also, is you seem to be sort of living a reasonably normal life in Brooklyn. And then you moved out to Long Island and the sort of world sort of fell apart. Why did that happen, do you think? Why? Because Brooklyn can be an equally tough part of the universe. And your problems seem to be greater in Long Island.
Yeah, I just, my parents chose not the greatest of neighborhoods to move to, Seaford. There's a lot of tough kids there. Kids were always getting into trouble. It was just right off the bat, we moved into a house where the oldest boy across the street, his girlfriend had lived there, and they moved away to Arizona because of her father's job. So he was actually angry at me because his girlfriend moved away from the house. And, you know, right off the bat, that just started a firestorm of things. At that time, I was a skinny kid. I had big ears, buck teeth, and I came outside wearing a New York Jets jacket, which apparently was the wrong team to be supporting at that time. And just kids were just ruthless, you know, at that time.
Why was the New York Jets I thought Long Island was a hotbed of Jets football fandom.
Yeah, well, when we moved there in 1972, so it was a little far removed from their championship, and I think other teams were more popular because they had, you know, notable people playing on the teams. I don't know a hell of a lot about sports. You know, music is my thing, but that seemed to be the thing at the time where the older kids bus, there was one central bus stop. You didn't have this where you pick up kids at their houses or anything. So you walked over to the bus stop and the older kids were still there waiting for their bus. Our bus would come after that. And while they were waiting, they would pick on younger kids like me and they would just tackle me all the time, you know, pretending that they were playing football, and they would push me into the rose bushes and throw my books down the sewer. And it got to the point where I just didn't take the bus anymore. I lived close enough to my elementary school where I could walk there, and it was not the safest thing to do because at the time, right next to our house was an undeveloped park, which was later to become Cedar Creek Park. And at that time, it was all marshes and sand and mud. And I actually walked through all that just to get to my elementary school. And I did that for several years.
And as you got older, especially when you got into high school, my sense of your life and the life of the book is that he was a reasonably smart guy, but he didn't have the supports he needed to be successful at much of anything. And that's, you know, not the best way to live your life.
Right. I kind of blame my parents for that because they didn't really care that I should fit in with everybody else. Everybody was wearing work boots and, you know, vests and flannel shirts to school. And my mother was buying me, you know, silk dress shirts. And I was wearing dress socks to gym, which really got me bullied. And, you know, nobody ever told me. And I never even had a friend or a confidant that was that close to me that they would say, hey, look, you know, you need to try to fit in. Otherwise, you know, this stuff is going to happen to you your whole life. So I had very little guidance. And to this day, I feel like I am very self-sufficient. through necessity, because I just have never had any type of support system from anybody.
And as detailed in the book, you in high school, you started the whole drug thing. Talk about that and sort of how that changed your life trajectory.
Well, I was always afraid of drugs. I believed everything that you heard on the media of how drugs could do things to your health and to you. And after a while, I discovered that my brother, who was 2.5 years younger than me, was already drinking and doing drugs. And so I started hanging around with the wrong type of people. I had a friend that we bonded over the Beatles and Kiss. We went to concerts together, but he had some older friends that were really forced him into the drug thing. And then one night I was just in the back seat of his car and they were passing around the drugs. And, you know, I gave my friend a look. I'll never forget, like, you know, are you going to help me? Are you going to bail me out of this? And he just like gave me a look like, what are you going to do? And, you know, that was the start of it. And, you know, I wasn't what you would call a stoner, because there were people in my school that would come to school wasted every single day. I just did it because if I didn't do it, I wouldn't have any friends. That's pretty much what started it. And I did it through college. And, you know, I don't have an addictive personality though. And there was one episode in the book where I smoked a lot of crack for one night and I wasn't really feeling like I had to smoke it after that. But, and even with cigarettes, I just would smoke occasionally when I went to clubs or bars, you know, just because that was the thing to do. But, you know, I don't miss it. I have some regrets about it though, because it might have brought on some future health problems and made me, you know, not too ambitious. I guess that you really retain that kind of stuff. And I think people need to realize that, you know, they'll say, well, you know, I'm doing it during my youth and these are the years when I should be living and having a good time. But, you know, there are always long-term repercussions that nobody really thinks about.
We're programmed not to think about them as youth, right? You know, you know, live life and all that. The other thing that strikes me about your story, or the story of in your book, is that the closest thing you had to a support system and a family were the drug addicts. You know, were the folks you partied with. You know, I don't have the sense in the book that you had a whole lot of support from people who weren't doing drugs. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, definitely. Especially my family. When I first got my driver's license, I used to party with my brother and I'd take him to concerts and everything like that. And I really wasn't a good role model for him, but he was already, as I said, he was already drinking and doing drugs. And, but as soon as he grew up a little and got his own friends, he kind of just like abandoned me, and, his friends didn't like me anyway. And, my parents, my father, he was a CPA in Manhattan, and he usually worked 6 days a week. So, you know, he was gone from like 5 a.m. He'd get home like 8 o'clock at night. I was almost ready to go to bed. And, you know, then on Sundays, he was too exhausted to spend any real time with me or anything like that. And my mother, there was 12 years difference between my father and mother. She married my father when she was 18 and, you know, he was 30. And she was like a true 60s hippie. Oh, she broke away from her home. I really don't see the claims that she used to make that how bad her life at home was, because to me, my grandparents were saints. They were really nice, good people, but apparently they favored her brother, who is he's in a successful attorney right now, and they turned their backs on her. So she was on the streets on her own at an early age, and she was looking to get married and have someone take care of her, and that's what she did. And I think the only reason she had kids is because all of her friends were having kids, and it might not have been the best option for her because she was doing drugs at the time too. I found prescriptions for Quaaludes, and she was doing all sorts of things and who knows what else. And she would just like love to be on the phone with her friends all day long. Or she dragged me and my brother down to the beach, Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, and just leave us there all day long. And so I don't think she was too interested in what her kids were doing. So I pretty much was on my own at a really early age. I mean, she wasn't overtly hostile to me, and I think she was more mentally abusive to me. Now, she would hit me, but she was more mentally abusive. She made it crystal clear to me that if I ever ran away or if I didn't like the way things were going, that, she was in complete control. Everything I had, everything I owned was hers, and, she brought me into this world, and she could take me out of this world. So it was not supportive. And I can't even remember ever seeing my mother and father hugging each other or kissing each other at all. So it was a very cold type of relationship.
Kevin, would it be safe to assume, based on your personal circumstances, that you were made to be independent at a much earlier age than was expected?
Yes, definitely. I tried to be more grown up than I was supposed to be because of my size. And, I looked older than I was. I was able to buy alcohol at a very early age. I did a lot of things that were not so great. I started going to the train station. I had duplicate keys made on my father's car, and I would take it out. I even banged up the front end at one point when he thought that somebody in the parking lot had just ran into his car. And my mother had no qualms about, eventually she got bored and she got a career in court stenography. So she was away from the house a lot. And so I'd get home from school and I'd let myself in. I'd have to find something for myself to eat. I don't recall her really cooking that much, nothing great in the way of housekeeping. We had mice, we had roaches, so it was just, feeling like helpless independence, I would call it.
Did you say you had a brother?
Yes, my brother is 2.5 years younger than me, and he got married in 1995. And I think that was the start of his breaking away from the family. Right as of now, I haven't seen or spoken to him in, I would say, a good 20 years. He just decided that he didn't want, whether he thought he had a bad past or a bad upbringing, I really don't know, because it seemed to me like he was always the favorite and the golden child, even though it always seemed to me like the oldest child should be in that position, but it was never the case. And it was never the case with my mother either. Her younger brother became an attorney and he got all the attention and the praise and all that stuff. And it's just that one day after my brother, I was the best man at my brother's wedding because I think my mother forced him to make me the best man. But, he bought a house in Williston Park on Long Island, and he was pretty successful. He was in finance, and he worked in the ring of buildings right outside the World Trade Center, and his brother-in-law happened to be at a business breakfast. He didn't work in the center, but he was at a business breakfast on the top floor on 9/11. So that, you know, probably had a major effect on him as well. But I tried occasionally through emails and things, and I really wanted to go to, he has two of my nephews and one of my nieces, three kids that I've never seen. I've seen pictures of them on Facebook, and that's about it. I wanted to go to the oldest son's high school graduation. I was not invited. I was never invited to anything in their lives, no birthday parties, no holidays, nothing like that. And his wife was so against my mother that every time she came in from Florida for a visit, his wife would go stay with our mother. And my mother knew that my brother and I didn't get along. So she'd have to make separate visits to me and then to my brother. So it was pretty difficult. I really don't know why he chose to do that, but I think it's just at this point is way too much water under the bridge. I have a lot of resentment of not getting to see my nephews and niece grow up. And I was hoping that when they became adults or young adults, they would reach out to me and I gladly welcome them into my life. But, you know, I don't see that happening.
How did you meet your wife?
It was through the Newsday personal ads. I was putting out a lot of ads. The thing about Long Island was if you weren't Italian, you know, you really had a lot of trouble, you know, getting dates because if you looked at the personals back then, they all said from the women, they all wanted Italian males. I don't know, whatever reason it was. And so, you know, I had a lot of first dates and really that was about it. And sometimes, you know, back then you couldn't see what the person looked like. So I had a few incidents that, some of them are pointed out in the book where I was supposed to meet a date and I guess they would see me from across the room and just leave because without even, you know, getting to know me or anything. Which is like pure looks, which made me really feel self-conscious because I always thought I was an average looking guy.
I want to come back to your meeting your wife and all that, but I want to ask you about your connection with music. You write about it a lot in your book.
Yeah, I do have a book of published songs and it's like half songs, half poems. Some of them, back in the late 80s, I was able to record onto 4-track cassette tapes. And you know, I still write occasionally. And my latest thing now is I'm going to try to get into AI, artificial intelligence, through music, which is because I don't have really much talent playing any kind of instruments or even singing. Halfway decent, but with AI, I can use my lyrics and they'll come up with a complete song for me with professional sounding music, but it's my lyrics. And the thing about that is you have to pay a subscription fee to most of these places and also the copyright laws, whether you get to own the composition. And my lyrics are copyrighted, but with that kind of music, right now it seems like a pretty gray area whether who has the ownership of those completed songs. So, you know, I'm just kind of waiting to see how that develops, but it's definitely something I want to get into.
But growing up, in high school, you mentioned a lot of the groups you listened to and you mentioned your experience as a DJ in college. And it's sort of my sense is that that was one of the few positives in your life. You know, you had the chance to, you know, to do something positive with that music.
Yeah, it was really, I had always wanted to be a DJ. It was more structured and rigid than I thought. I couldn't just play whatever I wanted to play. Plus, I had a Sunday morning show. I went to Bloomsburg State College in Pennsylvania, which is now Bloomsburg University. And that was a heavily drug and party school. And so they gave me a Sunday morning slot, 4 hours, where like everybody was still hungover and asleep. So I didn't have a huge listenership, but I still was always very knowledgeable about music. I know facts the way other people know about sports. And later on in high school, I got a job at a record franchise. It was called Record World. The name was changed in the book. And people would come in and they'd say, do you know what this song is? And they'd give me like two words and I always knew what the song was. And the people I worked for were impressed because, you know, people would buy the records, you know, once they knew who it was. And people would call up on my DJ show and ask me, what was that record you just played? Or I'm looking for a certain record and these are the lyrics, you know. And you know, nowadays it's really easy. I mean, they have Shazam and you just can sing into it or you can play a piece of something and your phone will tell you who the artist is and who the song is. But back then you really had to be knowledgeable. And I tried for many years to keep up with that. But, you know, it's just these days, I just, you know, like what I like. And so I'm kind of half of the artists today. I couldn't even tell you who they are.
So there before are, go ahead, Bob.
Before we turn our festivities over to our participants, I know Peter has a question, but before that, I just wanted to make sure that we know how we can find your book.
It's on Amazon.com. And it's also, there's a link to Amazon on dldbooks.kevinhubschman.
DLD, as in David and Leonore Dvorkin. They are my editors. They are fabulous people to work with. I know lots of people that use DLD Books as their editing service. They're very, very good. And I'm sure you agree, Kevin.
Right. I didn't want to slight Leonore, but at this time that I published the book, I mainly went through David because he knows the publishing end of it. Because the editing, you know, I am a very good editor and I don't know if there's any errors left in the book, but I'm pretty good at catching things like that. And I was almost an English teacher. So, you know, I feel like I'm the best person for the job to edit my own books. And I do like precursory edits of Fisher's books as well, just to make sure that, you know, everything is okay. So as time goes by though, the punctuation and grammar is kind of getting away from me a little bit.
Okay. So that's www.dldbooks.com/Kevin Hutschman. And that's spelled HUBSCHMAN.
Yes.
For those who don't know. Now, Peter, you have one more question before.
Yeah, and I should say it's forward slash just for the record.
Forward slash, yes.
So it is forward slash. You mentioned in your book, before I throw a progression, that you were a big heavy metal fan. And you also mentioned in passing that I think you mentioned the Grateful Dead as one of your bands. Is that, if the Grateful Dead was one of your bands, are you a Deadhead?
Yeah, they used to have a show that they ran from Hofstra University one night a week. It was for tapers of Grateful Dead live shows. And I used to sit there every week and tape whatever live show they were playing. And I had quite a collection of cassettes of those shows. And now it's been many years since I've had cassettes, but I've been reading in the media lately that cassettes are coming back. They're becoming very popular again. And I just started recording and collecting cassettes again. So everything comes around. It's like a cycle. And so this like showed me to never get rid of my, you know, even DVDs and CDs like, they'll be back, you know, and so I'm holding on to everything I have. It taught me a good lesson because now you have to pay a lot more money for a vinyl record album. When you think back that, you know, you sold your albums for 50 cents and a dollar each. So I tried to build that vinyl collection back up as well. So I'm currently looking for cassettes and vinyl to collect.
All right, let's see the questions we have from the audience.
So you are listening to In Perspective. Our featured guest is Kevin Hutchman, author of One More Reason to Cry. So let me find out if there is anybody out there who would like to ask Kevin some questions. Trish, do we have any hands raised?
Not at this very second. Guys, go ahead and raise your hand.
Okay.
So let us know when that changes.
You know, Trish, how we operate. Interrupt us. You're welcome to at any time with a raised hand. So I want to go back to Bob's question. You know, you write in your book a lot about, you know, how hard it was for you to date and, or the fictionalized character of you hard to date. You actually talk a little bit about in the book about, you know, being addicted to sex via prostitutes. Talk about that. I mean, how did that happen and how did you break that habit?
Well, I was going to the city on a regular basis to, clubs, like the Ritz, the Peppermint Lounge. They had a lot of clubs in the city at that time, and to see my favorite bands. They may be bands like underground bands that people never heard of, like, for example, Killing Joke and the Bush Tattoos. But I've also seen heavy metal bands there like Accept. And actually that story in the book about meeting Ned at Work was true.
Yeah, it's cool.
So after the show, you know, I would just like to cruise around the city. And in certain parts at that time, there was prostitutes on every single corner. And like I said, you'd be stopped at a light and they would just reach in through your car window. And, you know, I was just curious about it and feeling like I was never going to have a normal relationship. At that time, I was pretty desperate. So I just started doing that in the car, and there was an awful lot of other people coming into the city from different states and everything. And it was a big thing in those days. And that was like right before AIDS came along, and I was always in the back of my mind, but it really didn't deter me that much.
And of course you were still taking drugs at the time too, right? So
yeah, so some of the prostitutes I would, you know, do drugs with while they were in the car. And, you know, it's just, it was just one of those things where I just couldn't stop. And it was kind of like wasting my money, and I felt a lot of guilt about it. But, you know, it was, I guess, the only human contact I could get. So I took whatever I could get.
And what this reminds me of, I want to, is, you know, for us adults who are raising kids and are very critical of those kids who are doing things that we think are bad or just self-destructive, we probably should remember that if we don't provide the supports that they need, they'll find them other way. They'll find them elsewhere. I mean, that's what your book sort of reminds me of. And, you know, I just wish that we adults would be more humble about our faults and do a better job of supporting those, our kids and those that surround us. Cause if we don't, other people will do it. You know, why do we think gangs are so popular? It's the same basic concept. If kids don't find support in families and faith communities and their communities, they'll find it in gangs. And then we wonder why gangs are so powerful in this country. I rant, but I hope we all get the point. It's one of those things that bugs me when I hear stories like this. So Kevin, I want you to talk about Trish a little more. I derailed you, for which I apologize. So what year was it that you met Trish? How did that work?
It was in 1988.
And, so how old were you then at the time?
I was born at 61. So
okay. So you're 27. The book ends when you were 25, I think. So how did you and Trish meet? How did that work? Talk about a little more about that.
Well, we set up a date to meet at a local diner near her house. She lived in East Meadow. I lived in Seaford. And she brought along a friend, you know, just for security. And at that time, her hearing and vision was just starting to worsen. But it was still at the point where she could walk fine and she could hear on the telephone and function reasonably well. She could take buses by herself and that kind of thing. So we met and we talked and, you know, I liked her right from the start. And then I kind of forgot about things for a while. And then she started calling me and we went to the beach and we went to the movies. You know, I turned out that, I started having her take civil service tests because at the time she was in job training at the Helen Keller Center in Hempstead, New York, and she was learning typing skills and that kind of thing. And so I had her take a few of the civil service tests and she got on the list for the New York State Insurance Fund as a keyboard specialist. And she got the job. That was the bottom of the bottom rung on the ladder. But then I would drive her into work before I went to work every day. And, you know, we spent a lot of time together. And I took her to Niagara Falls one summer. And her mother just was beside herself. She did not want her going with me. She was very irritant about that kind of stuff. And she actually threw her stuff out on the lawn and told her not to come back. And it was a whole scene. And so it was a very rough period. And her father also made things very difficult. He was kind of a jerk. And so eventually I asked her to marry me, and this was, we dated for about 4 years. So we got married in March 21st, 1992. It was a week after her birthday. And so we're going on 33 years now, and it's been a rocky road.
I would imagine so, before we go any further down this rocky road, I know you mentioned you have certain disabilities, but you don't have any physical disabilities, right? You have psychiatric disabilities primarily, if I understand your history.
Well, I do. I was diagnosed with stage 4 chronic kidney disease several years ago. And I'm not that close to dialysis, but, you know, I keep hearing that it's only a matter of time, which terrifies me. I have type 2 diabetes, which is now under control, high blood pressure. I had sleep apnea. So I had a lot of problems, and the multitude of medications I'm on now leaves me physically very weak and kind of unmotivated. So, you know.
So talk about, as you were getting to know Trish, how you discovered her disability and how you sort of acclimated to it.
Well, it was a very gradual worsening of it. At the time, she could take buses, get to work herself. We used to take walks in the park and walks on the beach. And then little by little, you know, she couldn't hear me on the phone anymore. And then started emailing and she was writing me letters, and, you know, the vision was never that good. She could never see well enough to drive or anything like that. But over the years, she went from a cane to a walker to basically a wheelchair whenever we go out anywhere now. And so it's nothing that's really been diagnosed other than a genetic defect. She has 2 sisters and a brother, and 2 of the sisters have a genetic defect called Stargardt disease, which is supposed to affect their vision. One of them is legally blind, And the other one, I guess as she gets older, her vision will continue to worsen until she's completely blind. But communicating with Trish in the later years has been extremely difficult because you can't use sign language. So if I'm away from the house and I send her an email, she can have her computer read it to her, and she seems to hear okay when she has the headphones on, which seals in the hearing. So that's one way to do it. And if we're together, I usually just write spell letters on her arm or her back. Other people have tried it, but it seems to be something that only I can do, that she understands most of the time when I'm trying to communicate. But, you know, she has three disabilities, and it gets very frustrating for her and for me because it takes a tremendous amount of patience, and she doesn't have a tremendous amount of patience, but I've had to have it for myself and for her, and she's like really my primary reason for trying to stay as healthy as possible for as long as possible, because it would be a pretty bad outcome if I wasn't around. She doesn't have much support, you know, from our family either.
I think it's a remarkable story. You know, you did not have a whole lot of support growing up. You were not, let's say, doing the best, making the best decisions in your life. And you meet this woman who also had her own challenges, and you decide to get married, which, you know, which is an amazing piece in itself. And what I find most remarkable is that the marriage has been together for 35 years. How did you learn the skills that you needed? You certainly wrote that you didn't get them via your parents for certain. How did you sort of learn the skills that you needed to be able to, you know, have a successful marriage?
Well, it wasn't always that successful. You know, I hung in there because, I guess you would call it, from my heritage, I guess you'd call it Jewish guilt, where you feel like you can't walk away from a bad situation. And you can't, the only thing you should do or could do is try to make it better. And so if it's not going to get better for me, at least I can make it better for her. I've always been that way, try to help people, as much as I can, you know, not financially, but, you know, whenever I had some good fortune, you know, I always tried to share it with people, such as when I was working at the record store and I would get free concert tickets and things like that. I would, you know, go to the concert and then I'd go up to the highest level of the stadium or the show, and there would be people there screaming, and, you know, you could tell they were really devoted fans, and I would just give them my ticket stubs, and they couldn't believe it. They would run down to the front of the stage. And those are the kind of things I did.
And what does Trish give you? I know you give Trish a lot. You know, you talked about it. What does Trish give you? What is her role? What is her positive role in the relationship?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, she's the only person, and I can include my entire family in this, that, you know, ever truly loved me and is very supportive of everything I do and kind of relies maybe a little too much on me, you know, cause, she expects me to be like a Superman, and, you know, and I just do whatever I can do. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm especially talented at anything, or, you know, she just has all that faith in me, and, you know, that could be a lot of pressure too for me.
But it sounds like she's one of the few people who really had faith in you, and that you could be a better person, and that you could do things that I don't think you could have, you viewed yourself doing when you were in college.
Right. You know, she never kind of pushes me to do anything, but, you know, it's just, you feel like you need to not mess up. You need to do the right thing. And it's been very hard without any support, without any friends, without anything really. So it feels like it's just the two of us against the world.
And but you know, despite your situation that you've talked about in your book and in your personal life, you had a very successful career. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as successful as I had hoped for.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It afforded me the ability to know that if I worked for 30 years and were made it to 55, I could retire with a pension and I'd be relatively young. I had to work an extra 2 years because I was still 2 years short of 55 when I reached my 30-year goal. And in fact, when I started out as, they have different salary grades in the civil service. I was a grade 9 when I started out. And then I got promoted to tax agent. They would go on the field and make collections. And I started taking more tests, going back to school so I could take the auditor's test. You needed 32 accounting credits to get that job. And I was never a good test taker. And, you know, in college, like I mentioned in the book, I took mostly English courses. There was no core requirements for math or science, which I undoubtedly would have failed. But I was starting to get harassed at work. It was like, you know, as good a job as I was doing, it just wasn't appreciated. They always wanted more. And they gave me some terrible, terrible audits to do. You know, so the people in the office that were favored, they would get these easy audits on like mom and pop businesses. And then give me audits like on Newsday and the New York Islanders and, you know, like huge, huge audits where they'd expect you to complete them in the same amount of time. And they put impossible pressure on me. And they wouldn't really promote me until my uncle got involved. He knew a Bronx Borough president at the time who had some connections. And they really were forced to promote me to auditor. And they resented that from the first day. And from that point on, they made things very difficult for me. And I was passed up for a promotion to supervisor, which I had hoped to end my career on numerous times. So, you know, I probably would have stayed a little bit longer if I was a supervisor. But as you got older, going out and traveling all over Long Island in all kinds of weather and going into buildings with all kinds of conditions and the heat and the cold and everything, it was just wearing on me.
2 minutes. And so at this point, Kevin, let me ask, do you have any plans to write another book?
Yes, I have a mostly completed second part of the book that takes place right from where the first book leaves off. I don't have a working title for it yet, but it's just a matter of time before I start editing it and sending it off to be published.
I'd like to make a suggestion for what it's worth. I think you and Trish should write a joint book about your relationship, how you met, and sort of take us through that experience, because I think that's a really unusual story that you have. And I would love to see a book like that out in the market about, you know, the two of you meeting in unusual circumstances and addressing the challenges you both were experiencing and supporting each other. I think it would make for a fascinating book, and I would encourage you to think about writing it.
Yeah, well, I'll provide her with the ideas, but she would have to flesh it out because I have these two books in me because of what happened during my life. But, you know, after that, I think I'll stick with songwriting and music.
Well, so we're going to have to wrap it up. So One More Reason to Cry is the name of the book that we've talked about today, and it can be found at www.dldbooks.com/Kevin Hutchman. That's HUBSCHMAN /. And the best of luck to you, Kevin. Continued success. It's a great story that you shared with us, a very trying story too as well. But you made it through, and there's some positives here, and just stick by that. We thank you for being with us on In Perspective today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, okay. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, everybody. Thank you very much. I'm Bob Branco. He's Peter Altschul. Have a great week, everybody.